Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this Saturday, March 18th of the year 2017, just in case you didn't know what year it was.
Yeah, it's going to be that all year long.
We had an email in that asked us about the price of oil. Jake's already addressed that, about what would happen if the price of oil stays where it is. And the answer is Venezuela goes broke. Well, actually, they're broke already. Their inflation is now triple digit. And I would have thought, you know, there was a time when I would have said, okay, triple digit inflation, shortage of food, nothing's working right in the society. The country would collapse, except Zimbabwe has proven me wrong. They've been able to sustain themselves for quite a number of years with triple and quadruple and quintuple
daily inflation rates.
Yeah. So I don't know that Venezuela will ever do anything as long as the armed forces get paid by El Presidente. And El Presidente has, if he has the guns and the power, he can do pretty much what he wants to do, and I think he'll continue to do it for some time. It's always possible that at some point there will be a coup d'etat. That's a good French word, French term.
I think it's pronounced coup d'etat.
And I would say that eventually Russia will hit a brick wall, but once again, El Presidente has the armed forces on his side, and he's got the guns and the tanks and a great deal of comfort with using them. And I think the thing about European countries, when they run into deep economic difficulties, they usually invade somebody, and that's what Russia's been doing. I frankly think that if President Trump were to have continued with his anti-NATO statements, it probably would have encouraged Russia to start invading. And they really would like to cripple our system or cripple our will to stop invasions, because they really need to take a few countries to get some money to maintain their system.
Something about Russia in particular, they've been in a recession for 2 years. Some of that's based on the price of oil. Some of that's is based on sanctions from the rest of the world for their invasion and taking of Crimea from Ukraine. Those sanctions are still in place. They're not going away anytime soon. That was one of the things that Trump said was likely to happen, or he didn't say he was going to get rid of the sanctions, is one of the things that he said, so that we could have them on the table and talk to them. Well, that's not happening. If that were to go away, Congress had said that they would put sanctions on Russia, basically the same ones.
We had another question about some internet advertisements that a listener saw that indicated that the Dow was going to crash to 6,000.
Well, that already happened.
Yeah, it's just misdated.
Yeah, it's 2008 that happened already.
2009.
Oh, 2009, that's right.
In 2009, it was down in the 6,000 range. You know, if the Dow Jones Industrial Average started in that direction at this point, there would be so many people rush in to buy stocks that it couldn't get very far. And the reason is our economy has more than recovered, is actually beyond where it was in 2007. And those stocks out there, stocks in general, are based on, the price is generally based on earnings and appropriate valuations and dividends and things of that nature. And if there were a two-thirds drop, by the way, that would be a bigger drop than in 1929. If there were a two-thirds drop in the stock market, then the price of stocks would be so absurdly cheap that I don't think it is just insane to go down there, because there are people who would buy them if they fell very much at all. There's plenty of cash to buy them, and there's no reason not to buy them. Okay. Stock market crashes occur following several years of runaway bull market where everybody and their cousin is getting double-digit returns for consecutive years, and the earnings of the underlying companies have not risen to support the rise in the stock market. In this case, the stock market, if you go forward a year and you look at the quarterly estimated earnings in the future, conservative earnings in the future, and you multiply that times 4, the current stock market forward price to earnings ratio, figuring it that way, is about 14 point something.
Which is extremely healthy.
Which is, yeah, it's low. Now, there's lots of ways of looking at it. If you want to be a pessimist, you can look back 12 months.
Hold on a second. Let me just, for a moment, explain what price-to-earnings ratio is. Because there are a lot of people out there that, when you say that, it's a complicated thing. It's not, the price-to-earnings ratio is not complicated. If you have a house paying rent, and the house is worth $100,000, and it pays $10,000 of rent, and you have no other issues there, so you've got $10,000 of earnings and the price is $100,000, you have a price to earnings ratio of 10. And the lower the price to earnings ratio, the better, because that means your earnings are higher and your price is lower. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're talking about going forward. We have a really nice looking price to earnings ratio. Now, back to you.
So the in essence, if we look at the earnings of the stock market or the S&P 500, and we look at the and count that as interest, because it's being much of it gets reinvested back into the company's earnings or profits. Now, in other words, after they've paid all their expenses and taxes, they have a profit, and we call that earnings. And that profit, a lot of it obviously gets invested back in the company to buy things, which is very healthy. Some of it gets paid out in dividends, but the stock market is paying, depending on which section of the stock market you look at, somewhere between 5 and 7% interest in effect on your money right now in terms of earnings. Now, a lot of people say, yeah, but that's not real interest and we don't really see it. Well, it's not real interest on your CD. You invest it. It's interest is interest is interest, and earnings are earnings. And people have money, and they're going to do something with their money. And they have a choice between putting it for 10 years in a treasury note that will go up and down in value, and they can definitely lose money if they liquidate it before 10 years. They can put it in the stock market and leave it alone for 10 years. You definitely could lose money before 10 years. You could go to the bank and maybe get 1%, maybe a little more than 1% at the highest paying interest places around the country. So if you have a choice rationally between buying into something that has rising interest rates going forward, in other words, it's going to pay, historically we can see that over the next 10 years the market very, very likely will pay a higher and higher earnings going forward. So you can get 5 to 7% right now, and you can put your money in something where the probability of having lost money 10 years from now is so low that based on where the market is today, earnings-wise and price-wise, there just aren't any points in history where 10 years later you would have lost money. Now, that's not to guarantee that you'll make money if you invest for 10 years in a broad slice of the market. But I'm just simply saying, logically, rationally, if there's something that if you've been invested for 10 years based on a reasonable start point, which is where we are today, and you can put your money in there, or you can put your money in something that will earn 2.5%. Which place would you go with your money?
Depends on if you're the general public.
So from a purely logical point of view, the market is the place you'd go with the money. Now, when you get to the point, as we were in 1999 and 2000, where the price to earnings ratio is 33 to 45, and that means somewhere between a 2 and 3% yield, earnings yield in the market, and you can go to the bank and get 6% on a CD. Why would you put your money in the market at 2 to 3% when you can get 6% at the bank?
Right.
And the answer is because people got crazy. And when you see that happen,
and it's happened quite a few times,
when you see that happen again, and it will happen again at some point, know that the market is headed for that crash. By the way, at that point, you will not see internet advertisements telling you the market's about to crash.
You'll see internet
advertisements telling you to buy into the stock market.
Right.
You know, gold is overpriced right now. Why do I say gold is overpriced? Because gold and bonds have been moving in lockstep for several years now. If they move right together, and if we, I don't know what causes the price of gold to be as it is. Actually, I've got some ideas as do with India and China, but if you look at the price of gold and price of bonds, they're moving along in lockstep together, and we assume that that's where they're probably going to stay. And you look at the fact how much the market is up in the last 6 months, how much gold is down in the last 6 months, and you just look at the entire picture, you come to the conclusion that bonds and gold are probably a bit overpriced, maybe a lot overpriced. It depends on what happens in the future. The stock market, no. It's fairly priced for an investor, and it is reasonably priced going forward.
It's not as nicely priced as it was at the bottom of the market.
Yeah, it's not
but
a year ago.
At the bottom of the market, people weren't saying, oh, it's a great time to buy. They were saying, let's get out, which is the time you want to be buying. When everybody's saying get out, John Templeton said it so well. I believe in being a conscientious investor. When the rest of the market wishes to sell, I oblige them and buy. And when the rest of the market wishes to buy, I oblige them and sell. That's how you make money in the market. And right now, there's still the preponderance of voices out there are saying, look for the stock market to drop. We could see a drop.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as that many people are saying there's a drop coming, then I'm less worried about
it. And there's still plenty of the news media in the financial world saying the market is in a bubble, it's overpriced, whatever. So we're probably underpriced. As long as whatever the opposite of the news media, now if you, presuming that there are still magazines at that point, if you see the cover of the equivalent of Time magazine, whatever it morphs into, or Business Week or something with a bull on it, you see a couple of those, be afraid, be very afraid. But even then, bull markets can go on for a long time after they shouldn't.
Right.
So a good diversified portfolio is probably a good place to be, but fear is a bad reason to invest.
Yeah.
Which?
There's a side story. I want to throw this in here. It's strange. It's slightly political, but it's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is being sued in federal court by the Justice Department, which is a very strange thing. It's two executive branches of the federal government suing each other in federal court. Just thinking about that for a moment.
I don't think the Consumer Financial, I think it's an independent.
It is not. This is part of the reason why it's being sued. It is a part of the executive branch, but it is not answerable to the president. The head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
It's agency, I think.
It's a CFPB.
Okay, it is Bureau.
It's a Bureau.
Right. Okay.
The head can only be fired by the president through if he breaks the law or through malfeasance of some kind. And that's the only branch of executive power that that's the case. So the Justice Department is suing. It's based on some other lawsuits that have happened that the judges have made reference to the fact that the president's supposed to be allowed to fire anybody in the executive branch if he wants to, unless he's firing them based on an investigation that's underway, then he has to have really good reason to do it. So that's a weird thing. I've had some trouble with them as a whole anyway. And this is kind of a good segue into the border adjustment tax. I know you wanted to talk about that. One of the issues that I see as a problem when you have a federal regulating branch who gets its money by penalizing people for doing wrongdoing or corporations for doing wrongdoing, if they don't give that money to the people who are damaged, then their incentive is to penalize rather than to find wrongdoing. And Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's incentive in giving a big fee to Citibank was to give it so...
Giving a fee to Citibank?
I'm sorry, Wells Fargo. Yeah, they
a fee?
Yeah, they charged a fine.
A fine, not a fee.
They charged... They didn't give a fine or a fee. They charged a fine to Wells Fargo for creating all those bogus accounts. Well, I agree that they should have been fined, but I think that the money should have gone to directly to the people that were damaged by it, rather than going to an education arm of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I think the border adjustment tax is in the same area, in that the border adjustment tax, if you're fining a country for having a imbalance of trade with us, they trade more to us than we trade to them, we're buying more from them than they're buying from us. If we have a border adjustment tax that fines them, and it just goes directly into the coffers of the federal government as another revenue stream, then the government has an incentive not to do fair trade, but to find other places where they can find trade. And that's a problem. So that's, yeah, I know you wanted to talk about the border adjustment tax, so I was trying to segue into it for you.
You pretty much got it. We've talked about it in the past, that the border adjustment tax, it's in the tax bill proposed a better way, would raise the cost of everything imported by corporations by 20%. And if you go to a clothing store or to Walmart or to Target or to your grocery store, you will discover that the vast majority of items in there are imported. You may not like that. I don't have any problem with it. Personally, I think it's really good. I like the idea that in the wintertime we can get food from South America.
Avocados taste great.
Right. And I don't really want to pay 20% more for the avocados that we import from South America in the wintertime. What the border adjustment tax is a tax that will be paid by American consumers. It will be effectively a 20% increase in much of what you buy. It will result in an increase in the cost of cars. Detroit's already got it calculated out and figured in. They said, no, it won't hurt us. We'll just increase the cost of cars. But that means, by the way, that you, listener, will pay more for a lot of things. Will it cause jobs to return to the United States? No. I really don't think it'll produce any. It may produce a few jobs. It may save moving a few jobs overseas. A lowering of the corporate tax rate would keep jobs here very nicely. But putting a border adjustment tax in place probably will cost us jobs. And we can go into that in a lot of detail. But let's talk about the economy a little bit. And in fact, that this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And you can give us a call in here at 254-773-1400.
I just got an email that our phone system was doing busy stuff. It should be cleaned up now. Should be ready to accept callers.
Why, was it off the hook?
No, there's a switch that has to be. There's three switches that have to be thrown with this new fixed system. It's not really fixed, and one of the switches hadn't gotten unthrown from the last call.
Speaking of that, the unemployment rate's around 4.7%. I realize there's some people say there's a higher unemployment rate. It's really not. Because, yes, there are people who are working part-time who'd like to work full-time, but if you look into the details of what it was they would like to work full-time doing, it's things that they're just not going to do anymore because mostly it's been replaced by robots. For instance, a person who used to, my favorite example is the guy who was bolting on fenders for General Motors, who's now working part-time doing something else, is not ever going to get his job back bolting on fenders at General Motors. The coal mining situation, you could change all the regulations in the world, and coal is not going to come back. Why? Because natural gas is cheap. Natural gas is dirt cheap. It is a lot of, it costs less to burn. Not only does it cost less to buy for a power plant or someplace like that, it costs less to burn because it doesn't have any ash. It doesn't have anything that you have to get rid of afterwards. You don't have to keep cleaning out your ovens. It's just a lot less expensive method, and a lot of places already converted to natural gas. They're not going to convert back to coal. So how do we deal with unemployment, the high unemployment in West Virginia? And the answer is there's some federal programs that train coal miners and people who've lost their jobs in West Virginia and other places. that put them to work as computer programmers. And as a result, there's a gradual influx of companies into West Virginia, amazingly enough, to do coding and to do computer work because there's a growing number of people who know how to program computers in West Virginia. The problem is the president's budget cuts that program out almost entirely. That's counterproductive, in my opinion, but that's neither here nor there. But that's just where it is. Meanwhile, we have an interesting number that came out this week. The number of jobless claims has been below 300,000 for the longest stretch since 1970. It was at 241,000 last week. Now, when you look at the population, the number of people employed in 1970 and the number of people employed today, there's roughly a little over twice as the number of people employed today. But this is the we have a lower number of jobless claims per week on a moving average right now than we had in 1970. What does that tell you? It tells you that there's a lot of people employed. Layoffs are not happening at anything like the rate they used to happen. And what we also say, and you don't have to take statistics on this. You don't have to take the words of the Commerce Department or the Labor Department. If you drive down I-35 and you look on the back of not every, but many 18-wheelers, there is an advertisement saying we'd like to hire you.
Yeah.
We walked into a restaurant last night which has a now hiring sign up. I was in Austin recently, and it seemed like every business there had signs saying that they're looking for people to work. I called Best Buy. And if you call a Best Buy store in the United States, you have to sit through a recording trying to get you to come to work for Best Buy. Now, that is got to be off-putting because, you know, you get your repair work done
for less money if you're working there.
The point is that we already have more jobs than we have people to fill them. And anything that we do in the economy that, quote, will create jobs, I don't know how that's going to work at all. Because we don't have people to fill the jobs.
Yeah, and you said since 1970, it's the longest period below 300,000.
Mm-hmm.
In 1970, there were 205 million people in the United States.
Right.
There's 325, something like that now.
But if you actually look at the workforce is just about doubled.
Because right.
A lot of women went into the workforce
right.
After 1970.
Yeah, and I'm bringing up that population because we've got an aging population. More of our population as a percentage is in the workforce, and we have a much larger population by about a third. Just as a side note, when we talk about demographic issues, by the way, Russia in 1970 had a population of about 130 million at the time that we had 205. So they were only 75 million behind us. They now have a population of 145 or so, and we've got a population of about 127, 128, which means we're growing a lot faster than they are.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to fall back on some techniques that basically, by population, they are not going to remain even a player in the world power scene, except that they have a lot of nukes.
Right. Well, they have also a lot of tanks, and they have an army.
They have an army and
a
lot of tanks, but all it takes is the budget to really thoroughly mess up again like it did after the Soviet Union collapsed.
And they'll use the army.
And they, yeah, with the person in charge now, they'll use that army, yes.
Now, in the United States right now, our economy is progressing very nicely. Housing prices are up 5.8%. Housing prices go up when, A, there's a shortage of houses, and, B,
there's enough
people that can afford to buy them, and they've gotten more expensive. Housing starts are up 6.2% over last year.
You start down
through this list of numbers.
Yeah. All good numbers.
We have a very healthily growing economy, and there's just the biggest, and this is going to sound a little odd, it's certainly not what we're hearing in the political world today, the biggest restriction right now on the growth in our economy is finding enough people to work. And it's not a matter of people being lazy and on welfare or anything of that nature. It's a matter of, yeah, there's a tiny little slice of folks. But remember, we had welfare reform, and we chopped the welfare rolls a lot quite a while ago. And they haven't grown. They're still out there doing pretty much the same thing. The bottom line to it is, we possibly could get more people employed if we raised wages significantly in the United States. Instead of going up by 3% over the last year, if they'd gone up by 6%, you'd have a lower unemployment rate. You'd have more people employed. Here's the problem with that. We can't afford to raise wages, because in order to raise wages, we have to raise prices in the companies where you're buying things.
And we have imports, which means mm-hmm. the people elsewhere would be undercutting our prices.
It's not even that simple. We have Amazon.
Right.
And the point is, if you go into a store and buy something versus buying it from Amazon, where the person selling it, if it's not the mainline commercial item, the person selling it may be doing it out of their bedroom part-time.
With no massive overhead.
Right. So we're in a position where we simply can't raise wages. So we're not going to get
Except very slowly. Yeah.
I mean, 3% increase in wages, all things considered, is we're holding our own. And that's about
Correct.
As far as we're likely to get in this state of affairs.
Unless the person who's doing the job gets better at the job and produces more things, and that's the other way around this. If you continue to educate yourself, get better at what you do, bring in computers, bring in robotics, if your productivity goes up, they can afford to pay you more.
Well, that is the way things are growing. That is exactly the way things are growing. Productivity is growing at about 3%. Wages are going up at about 3%. Guess what? That's a 6% increase across the board in what we're doing. And that's healthy, which fits very neatly with the increase in housing starts of 6.2% over the last year. We're moving along at about the right speed. The economy is, just like the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen said, is very robust, very healthy, and at least from everything she sees, and I completely agree with her on this, I'm sure she appreciates it, The economy in the United States today appears to be quite healthy enough to withstand some shocks. Now, I don't know what the shocks would be. I can imagine a few that could cause things to be uncomfortable. But we have such a momentum going in the economy right now that we probably will keep going for some time. Again, and this is going to be very counterintuitive. We have a shortage of labor, particularly at the low end of the stick. I mean, down at the bottom level, and I have seen this personally, finding somebody who wants to do yard work, finding somebody who wants to do construction work, finding somebody who wants to do carpentry work is becoming increasingly difficult. Frankly, there's a reason for that. We've had a very successful anti-illegal immigration policy in place for a long time. And I realize people have poo-pooed the numbers, but under President Obama, there were more illegal aliens deported than under all previous presidents. And as a result of that, we have a labor shortage at the low end. And I think the immigration reform would be a wonderful thing to get through. I don't think politically it stands a chance at this point. But
yeah.
that's the one thing we can hit the wall on very easily right now is
right.
labor.
I've heard from the conservative side again and again, we got to stop the leaking before we can fix the rest of the problem, and we got to stop them at the border and so on. The numbers are coming back that more illegal immigrants are leaving the country than are coming in right now. We've got a shrinking population of illegal immigrants. It sounds to me like net, we've got the leak problem fixed. So let's reform immigration. It happened on its own, and I realize that the wall is a big thing. It's not palatable to talk about anything other than the wall at the moment. If we reform the system so that the people that come here are doing it legally, so that we can track them and make sure that taxes are being paid appropriately and that they're coming in as the demand for their job is there and we can't meet it here with our own workers. That's how you do it properly. That's how the H-1B visas are working. If we applied the way that visa program works across the board instead of just to the high-skilled area, we would have a healthy system that would recognize if we're importing too much labor or not importing enough labor. At this point, we're not importing enough, which is part of the reason why we're falling back on so much robotics, which, you know, long term, you don't go back from that. So at some point, we're just going to have the unions are going to be anti-robotics at some point. I can see that happening.
Well, I think the unions are having a few people involved at this point that it's they're just steadily shrinking.
The only area of union growth that we see is in governmental employment. Union growth there, it's almost universal across the board. Municipal, state, and federal government employees tend to be unionized, where the unions for corporate locations tend to be shrinking, drastically shrinking. And that the reason for that is because the laws, the labor laws that have been passed at the input from the union have removed a big chunk of why unions used to exist. I mean, there was a real problem and unions worked really hard at fixing the problem. And now they're still here after the problem's been by a huge margin, mostly fixed. There's still problems out there. But generally, those problems are labor law issues that can be taken up without a union.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400, and we do have some commercials to play. So we'll be back after these important words from KTEM sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here remain 773-1400. Local area code, of course, is 254. There was a big negative in the economy that occurred over the last year. Not well known, but first we got to get to a telephone call. So you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Jeff, sorry to take you back to the first hour, but I was just curious as to what you liked about the German healthcare system, or I think you said Britain too, and what you didn't like about the Canadian healthcare system. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. The German and British healthcare systems are not dissimilar. Well, that was a rough term.
Not dissimilar.
In other words,
so
they have certain similarities to Medicare in that you have a basic system that the government pays for, and you pay taxes to support. And then if you want a better system, you pay a premium for that. And if you want a luxury system, you can pay extra for that. So the more you pay, the better your service gets, the longer you spend with the doctor. In other words, there's a capitalist system built into it. And in both of those cases, now some of the physicians in Great Britain, for example, actually work for the government. I'm not real crazy about that, but that's the way it is. They've chosen to do that, just like some of the physicians in this area work for the Scott and White system, Baylor Scott and White system, and they get a salary. So what you have is a hybrid in those two places between a private system and a public system, and it's perfectly legal to go out and buy private health insurance and get private care if you want to pay for it. Now, in Canada, all that's illegal.
You can't. No private care.
And if they only have so many MRIs, and as
machines,
happened once when I was up there, if there was an MRI machine and a man had a wife who has a lump in her breast, and he got a friend of his on a research MRI machine at 3 o'clock in the morning when the thing wasn't being used to look at the breast and discover she had breast cancer and she had surgery and it saved her life.
And she goes to jail.
Well, she didn't, but he did. He went to prison. And there have been a lot of medical centers springing up along the U.S. side of the border from Canada. In Canada, they have a really interesting system that that is very restrictive and makes it illegal to have any private input into the healthcare system. And you can't go out and buy private insurance in Canada. Whereas a hybrid system, like the ones they have in Germany and in England, seem to work a lot better. Now, do I think that their systems are perfect? No, I think we probably can look at what works in the Scandinavian systems because they have both, they have this hybrid up in some of the Scandinavian systems too. But they have a population in these places that when surveyed are much happier with their healthcare system than we are with our healthcare system in the United States, and they're paying per patient in their nation, the expenditures they have on healthcare are about a third less.
Well, yeah, they have about 11% in Germany of their GDP being used by healthcare. We have it about 18% here. Some of that has to do with standardization, in that 77% of their insurance is governmental based, and the 23% is private.
Mm-hmm. And that's basically if you go out and look at Medicare. There's a similar breakdown there in the United States. Once you get over 65, almost everybody, not everybody, but almost everybody pays. Many people pay for Part A, which is you pay out of pocket for, and they buy supplemental insurance for it, and they buy this, and they buy that, and they buy the other.
Right. The idea here is if you have a – what happened with the Affordable Care Act is they created an exchange – of for-profit insurance companies competing based on some really rough standards that you couldn't really compare apples to apples because, well, you could. They're just all kinds of different kinds of apples. So it's like Granny Smith and Delicious sitting next to each other. They're both apples, but they're different apples. That's the way the health plan's working now. Medicare, it's the same kind of apple across the board. And in Germany, the governmental plan is the same across the board, and then you've got the private plans. And you can still go out and get those private plans. It works fairly well, and it removed a lot of the not-for-profit status at hospitals, which is an interesting side note, that the hospitals there function very much like almost any other business. They're not government employees except in very rare cases. That's something that we haven't touched on very much. The not-for-profit status of the hospitals here in the United States doesn't mean that they're not trying to make more money every year than they're spending. In fact, most hospitals just sock the money away, or they buy more land to build more hospitals on. It doesn't mean that they lower their prices when they make more money than they expected. And that's the way most not-for-profits are supposed to work, is if they make more money than they expected and they're doing something that is designed to be charitable in some way, then they just lower the prices. That's not the way it works in the United States. They're looking at expenses next year. We've got administrative bloat, where the administrators have to, the filing of regulatory paperwork, in many cases still in paper form at the not-for-profit level, requires a huge number of people just to keep up with it, just to keep them regulatorily in the same type of business.
And I think, by the way,
there's a lot of things that could be fixed there.
This is my opinion. Eventually, we're going to have, in the United States, a universal health care system that is paid for and run by the government. And ignoring it is simply because otherwise it will bankrupt our nation. If you look at the percentage of GDP that we're spending on health care in the United States, it keeps going up.
Yeah,
other people's don't.
Right. Let's throw this in there, because people are going to hear that and say that we're endorsing socialism and that it works better than capitalism. We are not saying that. What we have is a Frankenstein. A large portion of every doctor's education is paid for by the federal government. Medicare pays for that. The new doctors coming out of college into residency, a lot of their salaries, the vast majority of the doctors get paid from money to the hospitals from Medicare directly. We have a socialized system underlying it. Unless we remove all semblance of socialism, capitalism can't function well there because it's got this big imbalance in it.
We have a big socialist system that runs the show, and it's called Medicare.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, it's a socialist system, and it's all I've got, and I've said this to Lynn Woolley, if you're against socialized medicine, then you should be advocating to get rid of Medicare.
Right, and to some extent, I think Medicare needs a complete overhaul. I think it needs to be considered, this isn't going to happen.
Well,
but the whole system is based on government money from one end to the other, and the insurance money that comes in on the side is being directly competitive with Medicare. Medicare doesn't have to make a profit.
Medicare is being starved by Congress.
Right.
Now, let me explain this. Medicare cannot do two things. It cannot bid on medications. It is forbidden by Congress. And by the way,
can't
this was
negotiate,
a Republican-initiated position where basically if somebody comes out with a medication, United Healthcare or the Scott and White Healthcare System can go to that organization and says, okay, we're going to negotiate with you to get a cheaper price for the medication for the people who are under our system. Medicare can't. Which means that it pays a tremendous amount of money. The other thing Medicare can't do, and you know this is crazy, it is restricted by Congress in budget from thoroughly arming and funding an investigative arm to find physicians who are massively overbilling. They are way underfunded, and it is Congress every year gets lobbied hard. Nobody wants Medicare looking at their billing practices, so they get lobbied really hard, and every time the budget comes out for Medicare, Congress says, no, we don't want you having an investigative capability. And Barron's, it's in today's Barron's, or Monday, it's published today, Barron's, right at the lead where Gene Epstein says do away with the border adjustment tax, Barron's has come out with a very good program that would shrink the federal budget easily enough to cut corporate taxes to 22% without a border adjustment tax. And one of the biggest items is to fund an investigative arm for Medicare to go out and cut the fraud that's going on, by the way, that Medicare knows is going on, but doesn't have the resources to chase. Basically, when Medicare sees that fraud is going on in a medical practice, they strongly suspect it. They refer it to the federal prosecutor for that district. If the federal prosecutor happens to have the resources to go after it, they will. And if they don't, then they don't. And in many cases, they're busy chasing drugs or something, so they don't go after it, so nothing gets done about it.
Yeah, there's a side note here is that it's not all fraud. In fact, a lot of the waste in the system is through the complexity of the system. A doctor, say there's a doctor that wants to be in private practice. They set up a private practice. They generally will contract out through a large organization to do their billing because it's too complex. You have to have a whole team of people just to figure out how to do the billing because you've got hundreds of insurance companies. You've got Medicare, which is a big deal. If you don't get the codes right for Medicare, then Medicare looks at it as a sign of fraud. Well, there are a lot of codes in there.
I'm talking about the major fraud.
Right, and I agree with you.
And that's what Barron's was referring to. I'm not arguing with fraud.
I'm not arguing with you and what you're saying. What I'm saying is that a big chunk of the waste is through miscoding and misuse of a very, very complicated system where people are trying to do it right and they're messing up and getting either paid too much or too little, and they don't know which, particularly when they've contracted it out with another company. They just get paid what they get
paid.
If I could,
changing the subject here for
yes.
a minute. I said there was a big economic negative going on out there. I kind of like the negative. there's a suspicion that somehow the smart insiders make a lot of money and the rest of us don't when we invest, and we're in the investment business. And it's just, it's certainly not true. And let me tell you this, we did break a record. We had the most hedge funds fail last year since 2008 when the market collapsed.
That says a lot.
And these hedge funds, matter of fact, more hedge funds failed last year than opened up, but a lot of them opened up. Now, what happens is hedge fund managers make these wonderful, amazing claims, and people send them a lot of money, and then they fail, and people get back pennies on the dollar, and the hedge fund manager, in many cases, promptly opens up another hedge fund. And we got another call?
We do.
All right.
Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just wanting to call you to ask you, when does that Medicare come into existence?
For you or for the whole nation?
For the nation.
It was in the 1960s.
Okay, well, this is the only thing I don't understand, and I'm just going to just ask you a few questions, and I'll take my
1965,
yeah.
You know that, why is it that when the government comes out with a program for the nation like Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and all these other programs, and they work so well for so many years, and then all of a sudden, there's drama in it. Government has always had drama, and everything changes up, and then people are having to do something different.
Generally,
why does that happen that something works for so long, and then all of a sudden it goes downhill?
I can give
have a good day, and I'll take it off the air. Thank
okay,
you.
I can Thanks. Give you a really quick answer to that. It's the same drama that's going to come when we discover that the military retirement system is going to bankrupt the nation, which you're not hearing from anybody else right now. The actuaries said in 1973, the military retirement system, unless you change it and make it less remunerative, make people don't start giving them retirement after 20 years and paying them half their base pay so that you wind up paying them three times as much when they're retired as they did when they were on active duty, will bankrupt the country by a certain date.
Yeah,
and it is coming to pass. The same thing is true with Medicare and Medicaid and everything
Social
else.
Security.
The actuary said you need to collect more taxes, or you need to cut benefits, or you don't need to increase benefits. And Congress says, oh, we can get votes by increasing benefits, and they increase benefits, and they don't increase taxes to pay for it.
When Social Security was revised under Lyndon Johnson to be available to everyone at their retirement, there were 32 workers per retiree. 32 workers can produce a lot of taxation that will pay for a retiree's benefits. There are less than 2 workers per retiree now. That's the drama, is that
we saw that coming.
Rick Perry called it a Ponzi scheme, and it's not a Ponzi scheme because it's legal. That's really the only difference.
There's an easy way to fix Social Security, but it's politically unpalatable, and that is you have immigration reform, and you allow a lot more people to come into the United States legally and pay into the Social Security system, and Social Security suddenly gets well.
Or you make it means-tested, and if somebody has streams of income other than Social Security, they don't get Social Security. Again, not palatable. Yeah. That's the sort of thing that does not get congressmen reelected. So hopefully that... We can go back to your subject. Hopefully that hit the points for the caller.
Well, the big thing I want to say about hedge funds is that there isn't some secret whereby the rich and powerful make a lot more return than the rest of us. The rich and powerful in a few cases put a lot of money into some private something. In a few cases, they make a lot of money, but they also tend to lose millions and billions of dollars in one fell swoop, which you and I don't want to do. There is something called an efficient frontier, and any good investment advisor, as opposed to financial advisor, knows what that is, and you just can't get past it. But the point I wanted to make is that the number of hedge funds failing, which doesn't make the headlines, is in the thousands. And when a hedge fund fails, unlike a lot of investments that you and I are used to, like mutual funds, the creditors of the hedge fund are first in line to get the money, and then the investors come in second.
All right. We're about out of time for this week. If you would like to talk to us off the air, this is what we do for a living, is we give actual investment advice rather than education, although we educate as well. If you'd like to contact us off the air, you can reach voicemail during the weekends, real live people during the week, locally at
254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
You can reach that same line toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to our podcasts. You can read the newsletter, read our philosophy. Look at our ugly mugs and our beautiful staff. And until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.